Stay hungry, stay foolish.
So now on the Innovation Show, we welcome John Phelan, National Director for the H-Band Network and Chair for Animation Ireland. Welcome to the show, John.
Thanks, Aidan. Good to see you again.
So you're a little dig in there. I know, you're not the only one. This is one of those nine famous interviews that were deleted. I make it objective, were deleted, not by someone. Thanks for coming back in again, John. Thanks for your time. It'd be great to understand what H-Band Network is and what it does.
Thanks, Aidan. I suppose H-Band, in a nutshell, is a dating agency. It's the easiest way to explain it. H-Band is a Halo Business Angel Network, or the All Ireland Network for business angels to create that community, I suppose, the idea. What we do is we bring high net worth individuals who are looking to invest in reasonably early stage companies. And that's on one side of the equation. And then on the other side of the equation, we bring good companies that have great potential with good promoters. And we qualify the deal flow as it comes through. So we might get 400 to 500 applications a year. We'll typically put between 50 and 100 of those in front of angels. So the angels know they're getting good deal flow every year. So that's very important to them. An example I give you is that one of the angel forums I run just down the road here, we had 50 companies last year that were presented over the year. 32 of those have now been invested in, 15 of them through our own network and 17 of them outside our network. Frankly, I don't care so long as they get invested, but what it's showing is that the quality of the deal flow that 60%+ get invested in, which is a huge hit rate. And it's great for our investors to hear that and see that, that the quality is that good.
From a deal perspective, what kind of stuff are you looking for? So if I'm somebody sitting at home and I have an idea, what are you looking for? Like what strikes me off the list automatically and what gets me on the list?
If you're the company side of the equation, what we want to see is a company that has scalability and real potential. So scalability in our world will be how do you scale technology typically, and it has potential to go global and scale up quite fast with quite limited capital costs. So for example, something that's a tangible good is quite difficult because you've got to invest in the inventory and everything else, whereas if you have an enterprise software play, you build it. But the cost then is really just your sales. You don't have a cost of sales. So the capital costs actually scale it up, and your gross margin, your gross profit tends to reflect that. And we'd be looking for that.
Yeah. So basically your cloud storage or something like that would be the only thing that gets bigger as you get bigger.
So you can scale it.
Yeah. That's brilliant. Yeah.
And I suppose a lot of our investors will come from that world. And they would understand how to do that. And they would understand where the customers are and how to get those customers on board. And that's really important that they bring the smarts to the table, that it's not just cash.
Yeah, so to put it into layman's terms, so Dragon's Den, for example. So you're looking for the network to basically bring good dragons or suitable dragons to the table who know this space.
Yeah.
And they tend to back the horses that they're familiar with.
Yeah, and I say it to all the angels coming in. I say, you're better off sticking to the sectors you know and understand. Because typically what happens is that a lot of the companies that come in to us are well prepped. We have a whole team that preps them before they actually get in front of angels so that they're really investor ready. So through the Irish Business Innovation Centre, the BICS, the companies are brought to a stage where they're investor ready. We then have another team that brings them to presenter ready at that investor ready level so that they can stand up, they can pitch. They can pitch really well. They have the content's really strong. The structure of the pitch is really strong. They have a 10-minute presentation. They've got to get that 10-minute hook in to get people interested. If they don't get that, they're out of the game. So it's a really important exercise, and they should put a lot of time into that.
We had Michael Culligan in from Dublin BIC before, and he was saying that you do a lot of work to basically coach the companies through it. So they're not coming in and expecting to be amazing presenters straight away, because you have the great idea guys who aren't very comfortable presenting or talking about the company. So you kind of either matchmake them with somebody who is, or you coach them through those phases.
Yeah, and you try and do either or both, because typically what we'd like to see is somebody who's got a great technology background and understands technically how they're going to do what they say they're going to do. And then on the other side of the equation, it's somebody who's commercially savvy and understands how to bring that tech, communicate where the value is, and understands how to get into the market and onboard customers. And as you said, Dublin Big with Michael Culligan, and what Dublin Big would do is bring them to, they challenge them on all their beliefs and basically beat the hell out of them, which is a bit of tough love, as I like to call it. And I think that system works well because it preps them for the real world. But we do it in a safe environment where we can say things which a lot of other people can't. A lot of the consultants in Dublin BIC would come from the sectors that they get assigned to the companies. So they'd have a deep understanding of what the market is looking for, where the problems are, how you're going to get into the market, all that kind of good stuff that you'd expect out of a normal business. Where typically the early stage guys just haven't had that experience. So we try and help them on that front as well.
Yeah, so that, like it's almost drilling skills in before the big game. Yeah. And in that, so like I hate for people to get scared off by it. So if I'm a guy, I'm coming in, I have an idea. Will you help me put a team together? So you might go, listen, before you even present us like the idea, before you present this, we need you to have a chief marketing officer, or we need you to have you're a great business guy or business development guy. We need a technical guy beside you before you present, because do the angels look at the team?
Oh yeah, absolutely they do. Because the team and the promoters are what you're backing, really. The idea is one part of that equation, but ultimately it comes down to if the main promoter and the team can't execute on it, the whole thing's going to fall apart.
And who's the promoter in that? Is the promoter the idea person?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So you have the promoter, you have the team, and then you have HBAN behind being the coach, essentially.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, so...
I mean, all we do is support the guys. I mean, we don't want to take their glory.
Yeah.
We are really just that coaching element.
Yeah.
And we prepare them so that they can step up to the mark. And our only goal is that they get funded.
Yeah.
And we want to see them do that. We want to see them succeed.
Yeah. So basically what you're doing is going to, in a Tinder world, you're going and you're scouting both sides of the market.
Just sliding everywhere. I'm sliding left and right.
Yeah. So you're actually building the market as well. So you're building the supply side and the demand side.
Yeah. And it's taken us a long time to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been doing this for 8-9 years now. And when we started off, it was a startup. And when we had very, very limited resources. We had very little limited profile access to the market. We didn't know how many angels there was in the country. We now have a recent report from Intertrade Ireland saying that they believe there's somewhere between 120 and 170 million available each year in the angel economy in Ireland, of which HBAN, we would have brought 10 million to the table last year. So there's still a lot out there going on. And I suppose what I'd like to do is say, right, can we build that to 20 million at least? But bring into our sphere more angels who will get better deal flow and better qualified deal flow so that they get a better chance at a better return.
Yeah. So, okay. So you mentioned about it took you a long time to get there. Yeah. So can we talk about you then for a second and how you got there? So how yourself, because you've a very interesting background. I mentioned your chair of Animation Ireland. So you've obviously a creative streak or a passion there as well. So can we talk about that and how you got to where you are?
That's why. Yeah, we can, Aidan. It might take a while.
I have coffee here.
I suppose my first career was animation and games. So I started doing that back in 1987. I started in Sullivan Bluth, like a lot of people in the animation world in Ireland. When Sullivan Bluth shut shop, and it was a great institution. It was a great place to be.
I went there on a school tour when I was in school, like sixth year, and it was awesome. I remember just being mesmerized by, you know, the creativity and the process. But the process actually blew me away. It was like, because you think of when you're that age, you think it's drawing. Yeah. And then you see the process and the precise process of everything.
There's 22 different departments. And of those 22 different departments, they all had a different approval stage within each one. So I describe it's a sausage factory, that production process. And it is a very well-defined process. And I think what they did very well was they had the processes well worked out and defined. And I think that's helped all the studios here. Because now with the studios here would understand how to do a commercial process and from A to B. So get it from the creative bit and get it out to the get the show out on tape or whatever. But essentially the professionalization of a process as opposed to a creative, artistic drawing part of it, it's a very big difference.
Yeah. And you've brought that experience because we've had Dan Spencer from Giant Animation on. I've talked to Cathal Gaffney, and that is very much in the mindset of the companies. And you know, people think of them; they're just creative places, but they actually become technology institutions who do creative.
Yeah, well, I think why Ireland is doing so well in the animation world is that the infrastructure and the professionalization of the management side of it has been embraced. And I do genuinely think the technology that the guys are embracing and using, making things faster, cheaper, and turning it around quicker, which means the budgets come down, means that broadcasters and those who are financing shows can see they're getting better value by coming here. Not just that the talent in terms of the artists and the creatives are all there as well, but also that it's supported by this infrastructure of technology, professional management, and they can turn it around. And the attitude and the culture is good.
Yeah, because I had the fortune to visit both Dan and Giant and also Brownbag and the servers on site and stuff like that. So there's intelligence there beyond, you know, the guys have thought about the whole process, and it's just fantastic. I was just blown away by it. And but we'll go back to the timeline. So you're in Sullivan Bluth. That's where your creative juices started flowing.
Yeah. And then listen, I was a kid. It was all great fun. The average age, I think, was about 22. So there's lots of energy in the place. And they went through, I suppose, their own ups and downs, and eventually wound up in 95. 94, I ended up going to Warner Brothers in the UK. Warner Brothers, we did Space Jam and a few others with Michael Jordan over there. Great exposure to the UK scene. After about 18 months, Warner Brothers said, it's too expensive here, we're leaving. So I said, that's good. Can I take all your desks and equipment and 40 staff down the road and I'll subcontract from the States all the other stuff?
Brilliant.
So we did.
And what was your role to be able to do that at the time?
Well, I set up my own company.
Yeah, but within Sullivan Bluth and then Warners, yeah.
Within Warners, I was on the production side, so okay. I was a production manager.
Wow.
So
you spotted the opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I said, hey. And actually what came about was the network from the Sullivan Bluth days, who a couple of guys in LA had said that our studio is looking for outsource work. Do you want to do it? And we ended up doing $1 million in our first year. So it was a great. Yeah.
And you're still in your 20s then?
I was 25, 26.
Yeah, early 20s. Yeah.
I had no idea what I was doing.
Brilliant.
Frankly. And I suppose for the 4 or 5 years we did that. And that company actually, strangely enough, was called Giant. Which I always slag the Dan off with. But so we had a studio called Giant where we did a lot of service work for the States, for the large studios, for 20th Century Fox, DreamWorks, Warners. And we started doing commercials and we started doing some TV projects and doing a lot of co-pros with German companies, Spanish companies and everything else. So I suppose there was a huge amount of learning there. The learning from my side was that this is not just a creative process. Actually, you have to professionalize this. And that opened my eyes a lot. I also saw at the time that Toy Story came out. And I could see how that was killing the 2D world, which is the hand-drawn world, which is what we had come out of. And I think, frankly, we were quite snobby about 2D versus 3D. And we got caught up in all that. And again, all that technology can be very humbling when you realize how wrong you are.
Yeah.
So I think it's good to get a kick in the ass every so often. But after that, I went to the States to head up a game studio, which was a mixture, again, of a lot of creative artists on one side of the house. And it was a split like that. On one side of the house was all the artists doing all the pictures. And then on the other side of the house was all the dev heads coding in their caves. Yeah. And it was like, how do you bring these two cultures together and get them working together and doing what we needed to do? And all our clients were Disney, Mattel, Warners again. So it was a good, again, it was great learning. March 2001 came along. The dot bomb blew the hell out of that market because the games publishing market, that business model changed. I came back from that because all our clients reined in all their funds and said, we don't know where this market's going to be, so we're not spending anymore. And we were doing between whatever, 7 to 10 million a year at that stage. So when I came back here, I said, right, I'm going to get out of this. And I had a family, so we said, we want to stay in Ireland. How are we going to do that? So I went back to school and went back to college and did my MBAs, my QFAs, my corporate financy stuff. And
this was a far cry from the creative stuff you were doing.
It was, but at the why I went back to do that was I identified there was a lot of things I knew about setting up a business, doing the creative side, everything else. But where I felt I really didn't understand was how do you assess a market, an industry, and see where it's going? And how do you position yourself to be a leader in that market rather than being a laggard who floats on the coattails of everybody else and then gets murdered at the end of it, which is what I saw happening in the animation industry. I saw close on 5,000 people losing their livelihoods who were 2D artists because they didn't read the market. And I just wanted to understand that. I wanted to understand how do you actually assess a market and how do you see where it's going to be in 3 to 5 years' time so that you can aim to lead that as opposed to follow it up.
That mindset is very rare when you had that because businesses are still struggling with that and still don't do that. And despite innovation programs, they still don't do that. And what resonated with me was what you said about the tech team in one silo and the creative team in another silo. We see that still in so many companies. And Pixar, didn't Steve Jobs, he challenged that by putting the coffee shop in the middle to create this kind of watering hole that everybody would come together and graze together on their pasture.
And I suppose that as much as a myth, I'm not saying that the Steve Jobs one, I'm saying, and it is a myth that they are two different cultures that need to be kept separate. They just naturally drift into that.
Yeah, because
if you allow it to drift, it will. Whereas if you mix it up and bring them together and you bring that diversity together, they start finding that they have things in common and that they should be talking to each other. And then it all works fine.
Yeah. But you just, it's a good point.
Breaking down those barriers.
Yeah, on a constant basis. Yeah. So, back to the timeline. So, that was really, the mindset you had was so advanced in a way that you were doing, the reasons you were doing it. I mean, people go and do an MBA or a finance degree to understand finance or business or because they can. You know, it's not what a really defined purpose that you seem to have.
Yeah.
And it's becoming apparent the more we hear from you, John, is that how you've created the mindset you have and where you are is actually just perfect for that mindset.
Yeah, I suppose when you get quite a lot of setbacks and you see an industry's going down that you're quite passionate about, it is a humbling experience. It does require you to reflect on it and to be very open about it. Because people's livelihoods are at stake here and people have lost jobs and worse. So, I think be open, share the love, as I keep saying to everybody.
It's funny because that, and it's something I hadn't heard before, but we had Porik Okeji on the show a couple of weeks back and he talked about when you have those constant setbacks, it creates these new synapses in your brain almost where you don't see them anymore. You actually just don't see those kind of obstacles because you become, I suppose your skin hardens a little bit, your mental skin, you kind of get a bit harder to those. But also your warning signals or your radar or becomes stronger for potential threats.
Yeah, I suppose it's a bit like if you go back to your rugby days, Aidan. I mean, the more you train and the more you observe and the more your coaches tell you that, look out for this, this and this, and then you do it the first couple of times, it can be quite a struggle to do it, and you might mess it up, and that's fine. But then it becomes part of your toolkit, and you just do it, and you don't even realize you're doing it. So the more you challenge yourself to do things that you don't feel comfortable doing, I think my own experience would be that it becomes part of the norm. And then once it's part of the norm, it just gets done. You don't even think about it. Whereas if you always say, no, I'm not going to do that because that's difficult, it'll always be difficult.
That's a really good point, because brain scientists talk about that actually, and they say that habits are formed because your brain wants to save energy. That's an energy saving machine. So it actually saves those things as habits. Yeah. And the other thing was with threats, because I always used, when I coached rugby, I talked about this, was if you ask somebody who was in a violent attack about the incident, they'll remember the weapon. They won't remember what the person looked like usually, but they'll remember the weapon, because the brain is trained to look for the most dangerous threat first. And in a rugby setup, you kind of, what I was training the guys to do was, if they're coming to a ruck, so apologies for anybody who doesn't like rugby or not, but when they're coming to a breakdown, to identify where the biggest threat is coming from the opposition. Yeah. Because if you do that, you will see it like you did. Yeah. You'll see those threats coming down the line in any facet. And then you create a habit of them, and then you just see them always. So
then you move on to the next one.
Yeah, you build up.
You would hope that you get up to a higher plane in terms of your levels of understanding.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think constantly challenging yourself and moving on up is good.
So then you completed the MBA. What was the next step?
Then I did QFA, which is Qualified Financial Advisor, and then Corporate Finance. And I suppose my rationale for all of those was that I was getting very stuck into the early stage companies through the likes of Dublin Big. I just really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the challenge of not understanding what the hell was going on and meeting guys who didn't understand what the hell was going on. But then having a framework around how to assess what they were trying to do and being able to create a business model with them. I suppose the alma mater from here will be Mark Little in terms of Storyful and how we sat in a room and beat the hell out of each other for several months trying to figure out what the business model was. And it eventually came down to something very simple, which was syndicated news just coming out of different sources. But it took us 6 months to get to that.
Yeah.
And we went through a whole different, lots of different cycles of that.
Yeah.
And doing that with lots of different people in lots of different sectors, I just find it stimulating. I think it's really interesting. It's really challenging to try and sort it out and to try and help them. It keeps you awake at night, gets you up early in the morning, just trying to figure out what's the solutions here.
Yeah.
So I do that with all the early stage guys, but then the later stage companies. So I work with quite a lot of later stage companies as well, which would be the 10 to 20 million companies who are well established, but they need a strategy for growth from where they are. And typically where they are in a mature sector, which they need to understand how do they differentiate themselves from the competition. How do they reposition themselves? What's the new lines of product or service going to be? And how are they going to do all that? And it's a very different mindset, because you've got a lot deeper cultural issues to look at. And then you've got to move the technology, you've got to move the culture, you've got to move the politics, and then you've got all the competition around it. So it's all just interesting, sort of, how do you put this whole jigsaw together to create something which the whole company recognizes is the right way to go, and they're with you.
Yeah.
And that's not easy to do.
Well, yeah, but I mean, listening to you this morning, you understand, I mean, you have serious credibility there, because you've been, it's not always about the successes. It's not about the successful things. It's actually from, you know, witnessing and being part of the crashes. And, you know, as you see the crashes and burns and seeing the murder on the dance floor that you've seen is you know, I mean, that leaves the scars that you actually want to avoid in the future. And the, you know, the financial stuff, that's really interesting, John, that you've done that, because, you know, I struggle with that. I kind of hate business plans because, and you know, a lot of times people in entrepreneurship and innovation kind of go, oh yeah, you don't need a business plan, but you need to understand and assess the market.
If you're trying to get £1 million out of somebody, I think you should do them the honor of at least understanding your market, by going in and saying that I have a great idea, and give me £1 million. I don't think respects their money or their time even. If you want to prove it, you've got to show them that you understand where the real opportunity is. And that means you've got to understand what the competition is doing. You've got to understand how big the marketplace is. You've got to understand where the margins are. You've got to understand the pricing. You've got to understand what differentiates you. And you've got to understand the value proposition. A lot of those things probably second nature to you and I now, but I know a lot of people coming through it the first time wouldn't understand that.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely fine. That's just a stage of development. Yeah. So hopefully we can help them to understand what the expectations will be. But what I have seen in the last 5 years even is the maturity of the startup market, both on the company side, but also on the investor side. And I think it has matured greatly over the last couple of years. The expectations from both sides have professionalized. And yeah. I think that's great.
But it's also, I mean, and tip of the cap to H-Plan and Dublin BIC and all the other entities, because there's that paying it back as well. And I going back to the rugby as well, I see that as well in rugby, where ex-players now are coaching, yeah. Ex-professional players are coaching. And that's a huge difference from what was happening 10, 20 years ago. Last question for you, John. So if I am a guy with an idea, And I'm going, okay, I need to distill those ideas down into 5 slides.
Yeah.
What should those 5 slides say?
If you go onto the H-Plan website, we have a new video up there. And the new video actually shows you exactly what you need to do in your presentation. It shows you what the content should have. It shows you what the structure should be. And it shows you how you should deliver it. So if you get those 3 things right, and you deliver it with energy and passion, not over-passionate, confident but not cocky, you're setting yourself up for a good presentation with potential investors.
Okay, and what's the site?
It's www.hban.org.
Okay. Well, John Phelan, National Director for H-Ban and Chair for Animation Ireland, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Aidan. Good to see you.
So now on the Innovation Show, we welcome Director of Startup Ireland, Andrew Parrish. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Hi, Aidan. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on the show, and we're ahead of a great event that's happening on Spike Island. And what's really interesting about this event is it's much different than your typical startup pitch session that's become a la mode now and has almost been watered down into much different thing than it was originally meant to be. And can you tell us what the difference with this event is and the details of it, please?
Sure. Well, I think it's probably important to say that this event is happening in the context of a much bigger thing, which is the Global Startup Nations Summit, which is coming to Ireland, coming to Cork. And in fact, this is the first time in its history that it's been in Europe. So it's a pretty big deal when you've got 200 of the world's startup policymakers, community leaders, entrepreneurs and investors coming to Ireland because they recognize that something is happening here at the startup level, which is interesting. And they're coming to share their experiences and to learn and see what's happening. But all of that's at a policy level or a macro level. So it actually has very little relevance to the startup that's trying to build a business. So what we're doing in parallel to that event and taking the impetus of the world's startup focus coming to Ireland is we're running a very different kind of event. And I suppose what we see happening very often is, you know, week after week, another startup event, you know, with the same sort of format, the same sort of pitch competitions, the same panel discussions and PowerPoint presentations. And what we want to do is something that's a lot more fundamental to the hardcore nuts and bolts of running a business, which is tough. It's about being resilient. It's about picking yourself up when you fall and you scrape your knees and you have to go again. It's about trying to raise funding to get you through to the next waypoint in your business. It's real fundamental stuff. So what we're doing is we've actually taken over Spike Island in Cork Harbour for the weekend, and we're turning it into Startup Island. What we have done is we opened the island for applications, and we have assessed companies and handpicked the best startup companies that we've seen apply. And we've picked them on the basis that they're actually in the market, they're making revenue, they're making mistakes in their business by virtue of the fact that they're actually at a point in their life cycle where they're engaging in the marketplace, but they've also demonstrated the right kind of attitude. And that attitude is about sharing, collaborating, recognizing that they can't do this on their own, recognizing that, you know, in order to succeed, they typically need help.
It's fantastic the mindset that you're setting this up in that it's not about the unicorn, it's more about the cockroach. It's about the hard worker, the person that's not all about the fluff. I'm sure when you selected these handpicked companies, a lot of it to do was attitude rather than just the product.
Absolutely. And it's not that kind of, you know, I'm invincible, I'm going to change the world and I'm going to be the next Mark Zuckerberg attitude. It's more about that, you know, I'm working really hard to try and build my business. I know I don't know it all. I know there are other people out there that know things that I don't know, and I actually want to learn from them. So the whole basis of putting these startups in a secure facility, you know, Spike Island is a star-shaped fortress. It's over 200 years old, magnificent location. The idea of putting these startups in an environment where they are secure, they're away from the public gaze, they're not on show, and they can actually self-assemble into a number of different themes which cover the fundamentals of running a business, you know, self-resilience, leadership, raising funding, selling skills, telling your story and marketing, and how to use people and networks to maximize your opportunities. So by self-assembling in a group where they can share the screw-ups they've made, the mistakes, the failures, the challenges that they face every day, in a group of other entrepreneurs who can share their experiences and maybe provide some help and support, but also, you know, peppering that group with a number of really, really expert facilitators, business leaders, mentors who have been there and done that. And a couple of them, for example, would include Chris Payton, who runs an organization which helps both large companies and small companies to war game their business strategy. So how do you develop a sustainable, resilient business model? Well, you war game it. And this guy knows a little bit about wargaming because he used to be a colonel in the Royal Marines and ran military strategy in Afghanistan for a number of years. So in that environment, you've got to make sure your strategy is right because failure is not an option. And very many startups almost assume that failure is okay. And what he's trying to bring is that kind of, let's focus on the mission, let's organize yourself, pivot, change, you know, protect yourself as you would in a military environment, but make sure you've got your eyes firmly on the goal. We actually have a separate guy coming from the US who's a former Green Beret captain, and he specializes on leadership and self-reliance. And this is a guy that's built like a jockey. He's 5'5". And used to lead 6'8" gorillas into battle for the Green Berets. So he knows a little bit about, you know, leadership that's not based on physical force and strength. And what he does now is he takes corporate level CEOs and Green Berets that are about to leave the service away on expeditions. And he taps into that kind of, you know, focus on the mission that the military guys have and the commercial, you know, strategic view that the business guys have, and brings them together over 10 days walking through Patagonia or in Death Valley, you know, in kind of pretty extreme conditions. So he's kind of like a corporate Bear Grylls.
That's brilliant. The startups are getting such amazing experience here that any company that's been disrupted today, because we're all being disrupted, would do really, really well to get this experience and to get all that outside-in experience. And this has all been facilitated by Startup Ireland.
Sure. So Startup Ireland is an organization which is philanthropically funded. It's a community-based initiative. We want to act as a voice for startups. And really, it's about, you know, and Startup Ireland is fundamentally staffed, and you know, the volunteers involved are all business people. So they understand what it takes to build a business. Where I think, maybe, you know, if you know, to your point around the kind of companies that should or could come to the island over the next couple of days, we've called it Startup Island, but in truth, it's more about Scale Up Island. And in fact, you know, we are looking at next year kind of changing this so we do bring it to a higher level potentially and have different levels of companies coming. Because as you say, the kind of tools and techniques that you learn in terms of leadership, resilience, wargaming your strategy, they apply to any business. And I think maybe this is to the point that a lot of people who work in kind of the startup sector, for want of a better phrase, kind of treat startups like, you know, junior businesses, or, you know, when they grow up, they'll be a business. But the truth of it is, most startup CEOs and founders are smart people that are building a business. They happen to be called startups, but it's still a business. And we've got to treat them like business people and stop treating them like, you know, children, you know, playing in the kindergarten.
I always tip my cap to the bravery of startups, because I mean, so much sacrifice involved, and a mindset of, you know, jumping off the cliff and building a plane on the way down, and the sacrifice of so many startups that I've met. People have remortgaged their home and really burnt the boats to actually go to battle and start something new while, you know, sitting in a corporate job, while it is valid and all that, is a much safer place to be.
It's always a much safer place to be. And I think, you know, what was interesting over the last number of years in Ireland, where we went through kind of the financial crisis, is people that were sitting in those comfortable jobs got let go. You know, they were working in big companies that downsized and found themselves in a situation where they didn't have that safety net anymore and didn't have another job to go into. So interestingly, a lot of those, or some of those, through no choice of their own, became self-employed and became entrepreneurial. So you're seeing, I think, a new class of entrepreneurs who are a bit older, maybe have a bit more responsibility in terms of family and mortgage, etc., that are now starting businesses and working hard to scale them. But they're doing that with a much greater sense of the existential threat that goes with being a startup. Because if you're, you know, straight out of college, don't have a mortgage, don't have a wife, don't have kids, it's kind of relatively easy to go into a startup, and you might get, you know, 50 grand from an accelerator, and that keeps you in noodles and beer for the first year, and you can build your business model. If you're 38, you know, mortgage, kids, you know, your sense of risk is much more acute. So you will think really hard, and you'll put a lot more diligence into your startup plan, because you don't want it to fall over. And that's, you know, those are the kind of people that we're seeing come to this island, who really want the skill set that comes from, you know, business people that have been around the block a couple of times. You know, Chris is one. We've Brian Caulfield from Draper Esprit, you know, probably the most, you know, most successful venture capital investor in the country. I mean, the stories, the practical stories that Brian has seen from companies like Movidius, from DataHug, you know, companies that he's built and scaled himself, they're real world stories. So those are the kind of things that founders need to hear more of.
It's the golden handcuffs, and, you know, you called it out there for someone like me as well. Like, the risks are huge, so failure is not an option. And this work that you're doing and the team of experienced leaders coming in to teach is of massive value to any startups there. And I love the idea of getting the whole crew away from the public. It's not for show. You're not doing this for show. You're doing this purely to give as much attention and focus. And I'd love if you actually got everybody to turn off their phones, Andrew, as well, because that's the real challenge, is getting away from the email and all the different WhatsApps and everything.
And in fact, you know, Spike Island as a location is just magnificent, and I actually totally recommend it for anybody to go for on a you know, Sunday afternoon to have a look around. It's an amazing place. I was almost disappointed when we got out there and found we had a full 4G signal and there was free Wi-Fi on the island. But you're right. You know, providing a kind of a protected place where we can have those open conversations, I think, is really important. But I wouldn't overemphasize the risk for an entrepreneur. Entrepreneurs go into these businesses, yes, because it's risky, but that's not the motivation. The motivation is typically to go in and fix something that they see is broken, or to build on an opportunity that they've spotted. And they're motivated about creating something wonderful, hiring a great team, and, you know, making some money in the process. You know, people, I think, that start off a business and say, yeah, I just want to exit in 3 years and make loads of money, they're typically the ones that don't succeed. The founders that actually accept that there is risk involved, but just put it to one side because they're motivated by what's the opportunity, what's the problem I'm solving, what's the customer that's saying, God, if you could only do that, I'd buy it from you. They're the real business leaders of the future. You know, the people that want to make something great. And typically that takes blood, sweat and tears and a lot of pain along the way. But that's fine, because ultimately the rewards come, and the rewards are not just financial.
Yeah, absolutely. They're changing the world. They're making an impact, which is, you know, it's something that I thought about, Andrew, recently is, you know, there's a lot of talk about millennials and the fact that they're jumping from job to job. But I actually think there's something deeper at play here, that actually people are looking for meaning from the company they work for. And I think that startups and founders that are genuine, like the team of people you're bringing away,
are the ones that they'll work for because they believe in their product, and their product is actually looking to make a change in the world. And the more companies we can facilitate, like Startup Ireland's doing, to make those changes, the better the business environment's going to be in the future.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think I probably read the same article that you did, which says the millennials want to work in a great company, they want to do a great job, and they want to make a great difference. You know, so you know, when I was a rookie, you got a job to make money and pay the bills and go out on a Friday night. Whereas I think, you know, the people that we're seeing going into startups and particularly the tech companies now, they really do want to feel like they're building something. And that kind of enthusiasm is, you know, it does have the potential to change the world. And I think you're absolutely right. If we can create the right framework conditions, and this is, you know, coming back to the Startup Nation's policy people that are coming to Cork this weekend, that's what they do. They want to work at a macro level in their various countries, whether it's from, you know, Peru and Chile all the way to New Zealand and Korea that are coming to Cork. They're motivated by creating the macro environment that enables those business leaders and founders to actually do really well and to make a difference in their home countries. We talk about entrepreneurs always being at the business end, but in some cases, you know, the entrepreneurial flair also manifests in the policymakers, where they're taking a risk, they're recognizing that something needs to be fixed, they're going out on a limb maybe to try and make it happen. So I think, you know, we should doff our cap to them sometimes as well.
And what's the details, Andrew? Can the public go to this?
So the Startup Nation Summit is happening in UCC on Saturday. It's a closed session. So there's 200-odd delegates coming together to talk about stuff that's relevant to them. So it's not open to the public. It is open to invited guests and to sponsors who are involved. And I have to acknowledge Bank of Ireland, who have been amazing in terms of sponsoring both the Startup Ireland event and sponsoring the Startup Nation Summit. So it is available to people who have a particular interest, but typically the conversations aren't the kind of thing that somebody would give up a Saturday afternoon to go along, particularly when there's a rugby match on that night. The Spike Island piece is just for the startup companies, the facilitators and the mentors that are going to be there. And some of the mentors, you know, are coming from, you know, Google have been really supportive. Huawei have been amazing. They've sponsored and they're sending people along as well. Tyco, or Johnson Controls as they are now. So we've got some great companies, Microsoft included, all sending some of their brightest and best to intersperse with the startups that are there to talk through real business stories. So I think it's going to be a great weekend. Can't wait.
It sounds like it, Andrew. And we wish you the very best. Andrew Parrish, Director of Startup Ireland, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Aidan.
So now on the Innovation Show, we welcome Fiona Descadeau-Kennedy, CEO of Innovate Dublin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Aidan. Delighted to be here.
It's great to have you here. So tell us about Innovate Dublin.
Innovate Dublin is a social enterprise and it was set up last year. And what we do is we look at identifying problems in communities in Dublin City and co-create, co-develop and co-produce solutions to those problems with individuals, particularly residents, businesses, nonprofits and local government.
Brilliant. And so how can somebody get involved? I mean, if I had an idea, is it a community thing or can an individual come forward?
I'll tell you a bit about our model. Innovate Dublin sets up different Innovate programs under the auspices of Innovate Dublin. Dublin is huge, has a lot of complex social problems. So we want to ensure that we have an impact on the ground and communities. So we set up Innovate Ballymun, our first program, and we wanted to understand what the issues were in the community of Ballymun. We had all the socioeconomic data, so we knew what the deprivation indices, what the figures were associated to that. But we really wanted to put the user, the individual, back at the centre of the decision-making process and the community tell us what they actually want. So within Ballymun, what we did is we did on-street consultations with residents. We interviewed businesses, nonprofit organisations, and we came up with three themes based on their feedback and their information. One, they wanted to activate vacant spaces in their community. Two, they wanted to look at design and service design within the community and how to redesign services to better meet their needs. And three, they wanted to actually look at possibly testing products and services from the private sector in their community. And that came from the business interviews and consultations that we did. So with those three areas, we actually wanted to determine then, okay, so we have these themes. What do we actually do? What does the community want under those themes? So we set up groups of critical friends. You maybe had TDs coming along to a session, you had counsellors, but you also had, most important, the residents who live in Ballymun. So under the theme, for example, activating vacant spaces, entrepreneurship and growth for entrepreneurs and social entrepreneurs was a big deal. There was no space. And what's more, there was no vacant space for people to progress. So with planning and involving the key people that I said earlier on, what we did was we devised a plan for a social innovation hub in Ballymun, a space not only for social entrepreneurs, but for entrepreneurs and people who can grow, develop and develop their business through a co-working space in Ballymun. So we now have a social innovation hub that's 320 square meters of space, and it ticks one of the boxes in terms of the activating vacant space theme that was delivered within Ballymun. So essentially what we want to do out of anything we design is putting the user back at the center face. It's not dictated by government or local government, it's dictated to by the user, the individual in the community. And we pull in the expertise from local government, nonprofits, businesses going forward in order to develop the solutions.
That's brilliant. So somebody can spot, like, because when you think about like the Coder Dojo model as well, about like you're looking for donated space, but this is perhaps space that, you know, lost out through the recession, was maybe a vibrant area. You're revitalizing that because there's a direct correlation between, you know, active spaces or vibrancy or energy in a space. That's and right. People's livelihood and how yes. they feel living in those
yeah.
areas.
Yeah.
So that's so right. you're affecting that for the positive change as well.
Indeed.
And that has a knock-on effect on igniting creativity. Because we talk about creative spaces and you see a lot of, you know, big corporates putting together innovation spaces of nice colors, all that kind of stuff. It's the same reason it ignites creativity.
Yes.
But because we see there's some examples of that where donated spaces have been used as kind of creative hubs or innovation hubs. Mm-hmm. Drogheda, I think there's one.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, so this is great. So in Ballymun, where, you know, a lot of there's been a lot of neglect, I suppose, in a lot of impoverished areas, there's somewhere now that's a hub of energy.
That's right. That people who have an idea for a business can actually come develop their business idea and grow the business idea. And we act as a facilitator or a broker to, I suppose, connect them to the local partnership, for example, Leo, the local enterprise office, or any other companies they need to be talking to in order to develop their business and grow their business. So it's development of the ecosystem for entrepreneurs and social entrepreneurs within the Ballymun community. And as time goes on, we're hoping that the model becomes self-sustainable. We're almost breaking even after 1 year for the Social Innovation Hub, which is fantastic. So we're hoping to look to develop and grow that in other communities in Dublin and work with potential partners to grow that across the city, whether it is businesses, nonprofits or local government. But we're also looking at other projects. The Social Innovation Hub is only one aspect of what we do. As I said, under the theme prototyping products and services from the private sector, there's an interest to reinvigorate an area that was looking at manufacturing. We wanted to actually get people back into understanding the awareness of what STEAM is, science, technology, engineering, arts and maths, and engaging them in working with development of STEAM products or services. So we've been looking at what is called a mobile makerspace. So a makerspace could be housing 3D printers, cutters, machines to actually develop products and services or design products and services. So what we want to do is design a prototype mobile makerspace that can go out into communities, can target schools, for example. So kids can go in and look at making an amplifier for their phone. But they think it's cool and it's fun. But what they're actually doing is they're looking at science, they're looking at technology, they're putting arts and maths together, and they're working to develop something cool and fun, but learning at the same time. And it's really important through this project that we're not only doing that, engaging kids in schools, but engaging parents to encourage them and develop the awareness of STEAM and the importance of that going forward. Businesses, small businesses as well, it's very expensive to prototype and test. Whether you want to look at a new product in your product range for a business, or for example, actually look at different packaging, you have to send it off. It has to be manufactured. You have to wait for a turnaround time. Small businesses don't have the resources. They don't have the money to do that. So what we want to do is have a mobile makerspace that they can go to in their community. They can look at developing a prototype, but have a turnaround time that's less than a week. And then they can determine if it's something they want to change or develop or take it to market. So the mobile makerspace is another project that we're working on with key partners in the local area, businesses and nonprofits to take that forward. So there's a range of different projects that we're working on at the moment, but that's what makes Innovate Dublin so special. It's unique because we're working with the people in the community that actually want to make a change and want to make a difference. We're not bound by government funding. We're not bound by any rules or regulations. we're doing what communities want us to do and what the residents, businesses and nonprofits and local government want us to do in the community. And we're acting as a broker to facilitate that and develop the projects that matter.
Yeah, and that sense of ownership from the community is what it's all about. I mean, if you have any innovation program in a big corporate pushed on people, or I call it forced fun, if you had forced fun weekends away and all this kind of stuff, and, you know, whiteboarding sessions forced on people, they won't, it's like, that's not made here kind of mentality. But when it's coming from them and they're inputting, there's a sense of ownership there and a sense of partnership.
Exactly.
But I thought it was really interesting what you said about the STEAM with the kids. So the kids getting engulfed in this world is kind of like putting medicine into their yogurt so they don't notice it.
That's it.
You
exactly.
get it in there,
yes,
under yeah, the radar. Yeah. But it's, you know, you're talking about prototyping as well, and that, I mean, you're doing that as well. You're prototyping yourself. You're becoming the prototype that you can then roll out elsewhere around other places as well, which is fantastic.
I mean, Innovate Ballymun is our first program. And essentially, yes, it's our pilot, it's our prototype. If this works, we want to scale it to other areas of Dublin City and potentially other counties. It doesn't have to be Innovate Dublin. It can be Innovate Cork. It could be Innovate Waterford. So in time, we may look at a growth plan going forward, but at the moment we'll just concentrate on Dublin communities and see what traction we can establish by working with the people in the communities to take prototypes forward.
So your model is get your own model right.
Yes.
So get your model right and then move it to another area.
That's right.
Which, I mean, it's always going to adapt, and, you know, it's going to adapt to the local demands, I suppose, as well.
Exactly.
Like if the community's a partner,
yes, yeah.
that's going to change. Going community to community.
Exactly. It depends on what the core needs in the ground and the community are. And I think, I mean, this is, you could say it's under the realm, what we do is under the realm of social innovation. It's looking at new ways of doing things in communities. So what we want to do is actually look at a different methodology for working in communities, looking at how we can develop local and community through social innovation and putting the user as, i.e. the resident, back at the design of the services and systems that they want to see in their community. And I do believe this is a different methodology that we can look at, potentially look at with government going forward, because I do think the space for looking at social innovation methodologies for Dublin going forward.
Yeah, so say I'm a resident in one of those areas. Do I just walk in and just go, here, I'm Aidan and I have this idea? Is that how it works?
That's pretty much, that's it. I mean, the Social Innovation Hub is an open door hub. Anyone can come in and engage with the Incubate for Growth program, as if you're an entrepreneur or a social entrepreneur. Or we've just established a youth program, which is using design thinking skills to put the youth back at the decision-making process for themselves. So where are they actually going? What do they need to do? In Ballymun, there's a lot of local service provisions for youth to aid them into education, training, self-employment and employment. Very good local organisations that have been in the community for over 25 years. But there's a large number of them, and it's very difficult to, I suppose, find your way through these organisations. So essentially, our youth programme, Youth Academy is what it's called, is actually helping youth navigate through those service provisions and determine what is next for them. If they're receiving services from the job centre, they could be receiving services from our local arts theatre, Axis. So what is next for them? Where do they want to go? Is it employment? Is it self-employment? But allowing them to design that. And that's a 15-week program that we're about to launch in late September. So they can engage the projects that we have running through the Social Innovation Hub.
I was thinking when you were saying that, like, so they have a chance to almost do a hackathon on their own lives. Like, it's like, where am I going? And
that's it.
So many kids don't even ever get a chance to do that. Like, we all make decisions on our CAO form for
that's
what
right.
we're going to do in college in a whim, you know. And it's you know, the information behind that decision is not always rock solid. It's kind of preferences at the time without really drilling down. And I suppose that's what design thinking is. It's like, okay, let's get really to the bottom of what do I like, you know. Oh, look, it's fantastic to get
that's
that it. And even to get access to that skill, because a lot of people in businesses and successful businesses and big MNCs, they don't get the chance to do that.
No. And I didn't. I'm certain you didn't either previously. So I think it's something that we need to start to embed in communities and training programs and start locally by putting into the realms of the Social Innovation Hub through the Incubate for Growth program that we run or the Youth Academy. And it's starting small and advocating on behalf of what we're doing and getting the message out.
And how did you get involved, Fiona? How did you, what was your
The background, pathway? Essentially, I was acting CEO of the Ballymun-Whitehall Area Partnership up until March of last year. What happened is there was a national tender process for the Mainstay program that we ran, same as other partnerships. And unfortunately, we lost out as part of that tender application. So the company was wound down, but in winding it down, there was an opportunity perhaps look at taking the company in another direction. So this is what we did. So I worked with the board to look at a whole new strategy to take the company forward. The name of the company was changed. We looked at a whole new business plan. And Ballymun-Whitehall Area Partnership essentially became Innovate Dublin.
Brilliant. Well, it's a great story, and we wish you the very best. Looking forward to seeing it rolling out across. If people want to get in touch and help, or you know, suggest come to my town, where can people find you, Fiona?
They can find us on www.innovatedublin.org.
Well, Fiona Descoteaux Kennedy, CEO and founder of Innovate Dublin. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for your time. It was lovely to be here.